Behind the Screens, Behind the Scenes. Ein Podcast des Büro Medienwerk NRW.
Hello and welcome to the next episode of Behind the Screens, Behind the Scenes. I'm Sophie and today I'm talking about the project with a German and English name, in fact. In the Schichten des versteinerten Schweigens, Between the Layers of Petrified Silence. This is the first solo exhibition of Louis Braddock Clark in Germany, realized by the Kunstverein Arnsberg in collaboration with the III, that's the Instrument Inventors Initiative. And today I'm talking with Louis Braddock Clark, with Yannick Güldner from the III, and with Pauline Dutrolinie. She's the artistic director of the Kunstverein Arnsberg. Yeah, I'm very happy that you are here and we could talk about your project. Maybe all three of you, would you like to introduce yourself shortly and your role in the project? And then we could dive a little bit more deeper into it.
I can start maybe because you said my name first. I'm Louis. I'm an artist currently based in the Netherlands. Originally from Cornwall, which is kind of like a mining district where I grew up in the UK. And I work a lot with the theme of the Anthropocene and ecological listening as a kind of way of artistic practice. So I'm kind of working between creating artworks, researching concepts, but also this kind of imposter syndrome of also being a geologist myself. And the kind of techniques I'm using a lot is listening and amplification, which is about making things louder that may not appear to us immediately. So this is kind of the practice I'm working on. I work a lot with installations, sculptures, sound, film. It really depends on how the research kind of takes me to the site of presenting to the public.
Thank you. Yannick, would you maybe like to proceed?
Yes. Hi, I'm Yannick. I work as a curator in The Hague. I'm originally from Germany. I am part of III, for which I developed the project, space for art, science and technology and experiments with sound for new practices that emerge between art, science and performance. And next to that, I'm also an independent curator, working mainly also on the topics of the Anthropocene and trying to understand how popular and contemporary culture can be linked with each other to find new ways how we can communicate with audiences across different disciplines and create spaces in which we can understand each other better and can understand the problems of the current times. And in this project, I was the curator working closely with Louis on the development, but also together with Pauline on the administrative and production parts and all the collaboration aspects between the organizations and our long distance relationship that we established over the last half a year.
Exactly. And I'm Pauline Dutrolinie. I'm the artistic director of Kunstverein Arnsberg, but also I have also different roles. I'm also a curator and professor in spatial strategies in Berlin at Kunsthochschule Weißensee, and I share with Louis and Yannick a deep interest in ecological listening practices, the environment, and we at Kunstverein Arnsberg have a big curiosity for experimenting practices and trying out new and challenging projects.
Great. Thank you. I'm happy that we found all our way into a Zoom room. Pauline, maybe my first question would go to you. What, like, as artistic director of the Kunstverein Arnsberg, has inspired you to initiate this project? And maybe how does it fit to your understanding or to, like, the program of the Kunstverein Arnsberg?
Well, I have to say it was more like an initiative of Yannick. Yannick reached out to me to ask if we would be interested to do this collaboration. And I was quite immediately interested in the project, because also in my research projects and in Kunstverein in Arnsberg, we really look at similar practices. Like, for example, this year we have done a whole year program that was focusing on the topic of swamping. What does it mean to really look into ecosystems, wetlands, fluidity? And I think then looking also at the broader or the immediate region of Arnsberg, there's a lot of mining history and there's a lot of stones and there's a lot of layers. And I thought like that could be really like an interesting project to, at the one hand, connect to the direct local environment from a different perspective, and to also go into a whole new connection and collaboration with Den Haag, with Louis, his practice, and yeah, open up new worlds for our audience.
So maybe, Yannick, can I also like give the question like further to you? Why did you come to Pauline? Like, why were you thinking that Arnsberg is maybe the perfect fit to show this exhibition there?
It was a very surprising journey because we heard about, like, I live now for 8 years in the Netherlands and didn't have that much touch with the German field. And then Medienwerk actually reached out to me and was like, hey, are you not interested in finding a collaboration partner? And I was like, that sounds great, but the time is very, very short and I don't know anybody. So please connect me to people. And then they gave me a list of organizations and I looked through it. And I was immediately surprised when I saw the Kunstverein, because the program was so uncannily unfitting to its environment in the best positive way. Very pushing forward in what type of artists, what type of practices are being shown in a relatively small town that I know from my own childhood as places that are not maybe the cultural centers. Then I thought, let's give it a try and just call Pauline. And I think we immediately hit it off in the first conversation on topics that we find alignment with, that are interesting. And I had worked with Louis before for the last 2 years and commissioned another piece earlier in the research surrounding listening. And we were just spinning ideas to how to do another collaboration and how to develop this also further. And then it just fell into place, actually, very naturally, very quickly. A lot of trust from Pauline and the Kunstverein, a very strong idea from Louis, and then, okay, let's just go for it. And I think we wrote this all very quickly together and also found out how well it would fit to the area, because the research is obviously larger than just Arnsberg, but to the former mining and to all the work that is done in the area or has been done in the area pre-industrial revolution, all made sense all of a sudden. And then we applied and then we didn't think something would happen, and all of a sudden Pauline gets a call and it's like, yeah, so we have to do the project now. And we're all like, okay, cool, let's do it. And that was actually already very close, because it was in June, I think, or July. So to actually execute the whole project, we had only 3 months, which was a tight race, to say frankly, but also a beautiful journey.
Yeah, and you made it, I think.
Yeah, we did. And I can also say, like, it arrived really well in Arnsberg. It's a project that you see that is also connecting with people, like literally. People are touching the work, but we can go into details later. But I think it also really arrived.
Fangen wir einfach mit der Platte mal an. Die Platte darf gerne angefasst werden. Also wir schauen jetzt auf eine Platte, die so in etwa die Maße 3 Meter mal 1,70 hat und in einem wunderschönen Grünton hier vor uns steht, mit einer ja, wunderschönen Marmorierung, die ja, in hellere Grüntöne geht, fast ins Goldene, Gelbliche geht. Und was so besonders an dieser Platte ist, das ist also ganz das Muster, das wir hier sehen, was so an Blasen erinnert. Das würden wir hier auf viele verschiedene Blasen schauen. Das ist ganz typisch für diese Granitplatte. Also Vittoria Regia, ich spreche das jetzt einfach mal lateinisch aus, das ist eine Granitart, speziell aus Brasilien, ganz typisch in dieser grünen, leuchtend grünen Farbe und Maserung, Marmorierung, so wie sie jetzt hier vor uns ist. Wenn wir jetzt die Hand auf die Platte halten,
dann merken wir, merkt es vibriert.
Man, okay, sie vibriert. Ja. Und dieses Vibrieren wird auch stärker.
Louis, I wanted to ask you about the very poetic title.
Yeah.
Especially like this idea of the petrified silence. I really liked it a lot. So yeah, maybe can you explain a little bit why you choose these words?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great place to start also because on an artistic level, it's for me very important to start with a single material, almost like in a kind of elemental sense, like you start with this one piece and then you see how its tentacles form out through different chemistries and different processes. So the whole project is somehow orbiting this one object, which is a petrified whale ear bone. And it comes from the big blue whale, which is a whale that was like 9 million years ago going around the waters without human presence, let's say, and using low frequency sounds to listen and communicate with its environment. And these bones, they were very important because they're the inner ear bone and they're the ones that were actually used for kind of translating sound into knowledge, let's say, or into language. And they're kind of like the tuning forks of low frequencies. So we start with this petrified whale bone, which is kind of like a fossil, kind of like a rock. In a kind of museum context, it's actually officially classified as a stone and not a bone, which is also interesting. Yeah. So we start with this kind of petrified object and we look at the idea of how... to humans, it's perceived as silence in terms of what it holds. But actually, if you investigate this one material deeply, it's full of knowledge, noise, and reverberations with our current sonic ecology, which is actually ruptured with thousands of different types of sounds that we're just not attuned to. So it's really about this kind of relation between the geological depths and seeing also how they sound. And that's where the silence starts to become noisy. So it's kind of like a process of untangling, let's say.
Mm-hmm. And also maybe of, I don't know, naming these layers or making these layers hearable.
Yeah, I mean, petrification is very interesting because it relates to this idea that something becomes fixed and something becomes a stone and therefore is hard and solid. But actually it's not. It just needs to be... going through what we call like a transmutation. So like an alchemical process where you use a certain type of energy and therefore that energy releases it into a whole new realm of being. And I think that's really good to contest these ideas of solidity and fixed and static and into these kind of active processes. And this is also the type of ways we have to think about ecology now, is we have to see everything as living. And not just humans as being the center of living. So that's kind of where it begins, actually. And then the title is very much related to these layers, I think. And it resonated with everyone. I think with Yannick, we were just like throwing words around. And then with Pauline, we also worked into this title. And then it really related to Arnsberg. It really related to the context of swamping. And it really fitted somehow.
I mean, titles are super important for projects. And I think like when they actually really frame in one title what a project is about, I think it's a really win situation because it talks about the complexity of the things, but it also brings in, as you say, poetics and layers in between. And it opens up something of curiosity.
I think also on top of that, also the petrified silence has been something that has been going around with Louis for a while, this question of how can we listen to things that are actually the question how to petrify sound. So how to shapeshift something that is an ephemeral medium into a physicality that is withstanding time and staying for so much longer. And I think also in that sense, in this project, it also really came to be is to like how to attune to ecologies that have been long, long, long past our time frame and our human understanding, which is, yeah, on top also nice. And the connection to the slate of the area even makes more sense. I think that's what local people in the German context really, really relate to is, yeah, slate, Schiefer is everywhere in Arnsberg and in the Sauerland. And everybody knows how layered it is.
Yeah. Yeah, you can actually like really see it. So this was like the beginning. And then this exhibition features two big, like very big installations of Louis.
At the moment, the current title is called As Gems in Metal. And it's relating to, one is called As Gems in Metal Face 1 and one is called As Gems in Metal Face 2. And we use the word face, which is coming from a geological terminology where you have the face of a rock or a face of a mine, which is the area in which you extract from. So they're kind of two faces in a geological sense, but also in this idea of they face each other and they're in dialogue with each other. So they have the same kind of title, but they're two different works, two different faces.
I think it's good to have not two complex words that people don't have a clue what it means. And I think like also with this face, it's kind of they're facing each other, right? Like in the installation, they're really like looking and communicating with each other. And I think also this transformation of perceiving from a non-human perspective also really comes into play. Because, yeah, apprehensible also, like maybe how a stone vibrates, perceives, and what are the aspects within it. And I think that allows it also for me to look at it that way.
In the beginning, it was one exhibition that consisted of two ideas that are orbiting around each other. And I think in the process, what you can really see is they become one work with indeed two faces, with two sides of it. And they use the same language. So they actually really communicate with one another. And this was something that we didn't know when the project was started. One is you write for a funding application and you try to understand what the work actually is, to then the process of what the work becomes. And in that process, they really became one thing with indeed two outlets, but the language used within everything is coming from geology, and also the sound actually is not two separate works anymore. It is one soundscape that goes through the whole space that then actually really makes your communication to the outside world one voice that finds two different outlets that are also still interrelated and interconnected.
And what I'm also thinking about, especially in English language, when you say you are facing something, is also like you are confronting yourself with something. So I think that also mm-hmm. fits quite a lot with this idea of having two faces that you are confronting yourself with. Or maybe they are confronting themselves also. Could you maybe give now some examples, like the visitors of this exhibition, what do they see when they interact with these faces?
The first piece, As Gems in Metal, Face 1, is a large piece of actually lava stone, which is coming from, underwater East Brazil. And it's a large stone slab, which is in a ratio of 16 by 9. So it's relating to this idea of this theory I'm trying to research called geological cinema, which is the idea that geology and ecology itself is producing its own films. It doesn't need a director or a film crew. It's already producing its own types of cinema. And so the stone is cut to 16:9 ratio, which is the standardized cinema ratio. And then it's very thin, so it's 2 centimeters thin. So it's also a very resonant body. It actually can be tuned somehow because of its thin fragility. And it is pretty heavy. It's quite a, it was quite a thing to produce and maneuver and work with.
The plate is 3.2 meters by 1.70, 2 centimeters, and weighing 350 kilos. So it's really like a more than human slab piece that you enter.
Entstanden ist dieses Blasenmuster durch vulkanische Tätigkeit unter im Meer. Und es sind Lavablasen aufgestiegen, erkaltet und im Laufe dieser vielen Jahre, die vergangen sind, wieder abgesunken. Sie sind zusammengedrückt worden, Sedimente, andere Teilchen haben sich dazwischen gelegt. Und das, was wir eben, was so typisch ist, dieses blasige Muster, sind also diese früheren Lavablasen.
Die eben so ganz komprimiert da
genau,
jetzt.
Genau. Und jetzt quasi natürlich keinen Inhalt mehr haben, aber in ihrer äußeren Form noch zu sehen sind.
Ja, bisschen wie so Seifenblasen. Mhm,
genau, genau.
Genau.
Ja, heutzutage wird das auch gerne im hochpreisigen Küchenbau genommen, habe ich festgestellt. Ja, nun wieder ernst.
I've been working a lot with scientists, biologists, chemists, geologists for the last, I don't know, 6 years, 5 years. And actually the piece is also made by these geologists that I work with in Utrecht, Annick van der Boom. She basically looked at the stone and said, if I was going to extract the stone, I would put a hole here, a hole here, a hole here, a hole here, and I would drill sample holes. These are normally called drill cores. And I would then take these to the lab and analyze them. And then the data would go to, let's say, a private company or a research body. And then they would investigate what types of minerals are inside and then whether it's worth opening a big mine in that area. So there is this process of extraction that happens already in the research where you are, as an audience, confronted with this slice of mineral that has already been mined. It's been cut to a cinematic screen, so it becomes a kind of time-based media. And then it is drilled, actually, by a scientific methodology. So everything is kind of following this process. I don't try, like in the artistic process, I don't try and change the existing forms of extraction. I actually follow them and then add in these kind of interventions, let's say, all these kind of cultural twists that happen.
Wir können hier so Ausstanzungslöcher sehen. Und ich hatte ja schon gesagt, dass der Künstler sich mit Infraschall beschäftigt, schon eine ganze Weile. Ist quasi wie so ein bisschen so ein roter Faden in seinen Werken, also ist immer wieder mit dabei. Man weiß ja, dass Wale und auch Elefanten per Infraschall über weite Distanzen kommunizieren. Und um quasi wieder jetzt so einen Bogen zum Infraschall zu schlagen und der Vibration dieser Platte, hat er fossile Hörknöchelchen vom Wal, die waren Bergbau, Schutt, Abfallprodukt in North Carolina, soweit ich weiß, werden einfach weggeschmissen worden und er hat sich dann gedacht, Mensch, das schließt hier den Bogen wieder, hat die aufgearbeitet wie Gesteinsproben, also gemahlen mit verschiedenen chemischen Substanzen werden die zum Teil bearbeitet, deswegen sind sie auch in dieser weißen Form.
Genau.
Ich habe hier,
die werden dann wieder weiß, die sind vorher nämlich schwarz.
Genau, ich habe hier ein schwarzes Exemplar liegen,
ja.
So wie das Fossile.
Das ist so richtig schwarz auch.
Hörknöchelchen, ja. Genau, von innen etwas heller, aber so wie es halt im Original gewesen ist. Und ich glaube, es ist ihm auch schwer gefallen, das zu zermalen. Hat ein bisschen gehadert, ob das, ob man das wirklich machen kann, aber wie gesagt, es wäre sowieso weggeschmissen worden. Das war Bergbauschutt. Hm. Genau.
These holes is actually where we create these petrified silence, which is using an alchemical process of transmutation, where we take these whale ears and we powderize them and we heat them up and we work with silica, which is one of the main fossilization processes. So we were using these old recipes, these manuscripts from alchemists in the 18th century who were confronting the ideas of materials that both held life and death. And within these states of life and death, they were talking a lot about bones that had become stones and petrified, and whether you could release a state of living and a state of death within these bodies. So we worked with this kind of concept, these old manuscripts. And also, just to say, we never knew any of this would actually work. It's like, it's all theoretical based on a science level. But then when you start to find old documents and you're in a very kind of short period of time, you just have to try these things. And there were experiments that didn't work, but a lot of them did work. And we had these black petrified whale ears. We powderized, we turned them into silica with an amazing glass manufacturer called Van Tetterode in Amsterdam. And it turned out that they turned into these giant white discs, which had kind of like, yeah. So they transformed completely their color, their body, their shape, their form. But they also held in different gases from 9 million years ago. So there's this whole cosmology of a world that we don't know inside these holes. So that's kind of the main body of this work as Gems and Metal Phase One.
Von all diesen Scheiben mit den Walknöchelchen drin gehen nochmal so goldene Linien aus. Und wenn wir mal so drauf schauen, dann sehen wir, dass die eigentlich alle zur Mitte zeigen.
Genau, und die Mitte ist eigentlich leer.
Also, genau.
Ja.
Genau. Das ist keine willkürliche Einzeichnung, sondern Clark arbeitet viel mit Wissenschaftlern zusammen und er hat hier eine Geologin gebeten, sich das anzugucken und zu sagen, Mensch, wenn man das so jetzt in der Erde vorfinden würde, wo würde man denn da bohren? Wo könnte man jetzt vermuten, dass, was weiß ich, seltene Erden, irgendwas, was so wichtig ist in unserer Zeit, dass das vorhanden wäre? Und das sind eben diese ausgestanzten Scheiben,
wo eben dieser zermahlene Wal in Ohrknochen, versteinerte Wal in Ohrknochen hineingesetzt wurde wieder.
Genau, genau. Also diese Stanzlöcher sind damit dann wieder aufgefüllt worden. Und
um quasi vielleicht auch nochmal eine neue Ebene aufzumachen, wie man auf diesen Stein jetzt guckt aus einer Sicht von einer Person, die ja quasi den Stein extrahieren möchte.
Und diese goldenen Linien, die zeigen an, okay, wenn ich jetzt hier meine Bohrung gemacht habe, wo würde ich denn dann sonst noch weiter bohren? Also die geben quasi die Linien oder die Richtung vor, wie die Bohrung, sollte das jetzt hier erfolgreich sein, weiter fortgesetzt wird.
Ja, ja.
There is this kind of cartography that is also layered into the stone, which is the holes that are drilled in relation to the geological extraction process. The scientists also draw these mapping lines. So they also talk about ways in which the stone would fracture, the points of interest, but also there is this kind of idea of going deeper into the face. So normally when you take a slab of stone off the cliff or off the mine wall, you want to go deeper and keep investigating. And there's this kind of perpetual extraction mentality of going for more, getting more, extracting deeper. And that's very present in this cartography that we see on the face of the stone, is that there is this idea of going in and taking more and extracting deeper.
Ja, bei den goldenen Linien sieht man auch nochmal schön, dass diese, ich nenne das jetzt einfach mal Fräsmaschine, wie das genau heißt, weiß ich nicht, dass die das Material auch nicht gleichmäßig wegnimmt. Also man sieht, dass diese Platte nicht überall die gleiche Festigkeit hat. Also man sieht Stellen, wo das nur so oberflächlich weggenommen ist, dann spürt man so Vertiefungen, also wie so Rillen. Und das sind halt dann die Stellen, wo der Stein weicher ist und wo trotz gleichem Druck aber eben mehr Material weggenommen wurde.
Also kann man eigentlich auch spüren mit dem Finger.
Genau, wenn man mit dem Finger so über diese goldenen Linien fährt.
Wie der auch so nachgegeben
genau, hat. Genau.
Eigentlich schön.
What I think also can be a nice add to how to understand this idea of geological cinema a little bit better is we now see a 2-centimeter slab of a piece of large piece of rock. So how I, when Louis started to explain it to me, how I made it visualize for myself was if I press stop on a, while I watch a film, I get a still frame of the film. And in terms of geological cinema, what we actually do, and also if you are in these production houses for stones, they do this actually. So they extract the stone and then they cut from a big slab, they cut all the 2 centimeters and they become like a stop motion film. Because this is if you want to do very beautiful bathrooms, you want that these lines can continue, these marble lines can continue across different stones. And then it really becomes apparent that you have frames of something. So we actually took one frame out of the film, which the stone is in itself, the 2 billion year long film. We took 1 second, one snapshot out of it and put it somewhere else for you to see. And this is why it's moving image while it's still, in that sense.
Das Video dauert 45 Minuten und so viel Sekunden. Ist im Prinzip eine Kommaverschiebung unseres Erdzeitalters. Er hat auch darauf geachtet, dass Bildschirm und Platte im 16:9 Schnitt sind, so wie unsere Kinoleinwände, Bildschirme vom PC. Weil wir gucken ja im Prinzip einerseits auf diese Platte und wir gucken auf den Film.
As Gems and Metal Phase 2, this is a film, but it's kind of on a different magnitude. So we look at a film that is, I don't know, 3 microns thick. So it's a stone that has gone from an archive. So we're working with a giant archive of fin sections, which is stones that are basically sampled from all the holes that are normally drilled out. And then they're grinded down to 3 microns thick and then basically analyzed by chemists and geologists or private mining companies to see if they have rare earth minerals inside. And actually these are also, like, when I first saw these archives of these fin sections, which are like tiny, tiny little transparent samples, the first thing I thought was they're frames like in an analog film strip. They look like a piece of organized geological media in their own right. They're just badly organized and being used in the wrong way, in a sense. So we take these samples and we shine a polarized light through them, and which means that the crystals inside the mineral refract and diffract and they start to illuminate themselves and speak. And they have a language, in a sense, through light. And we use a tiny little camera inside this to document and film and scan every single piece as if a geologist was analyzing them. And so what happens is with this film, we were speaking to the geologists in TU Delft, and they were in the process of developing a machine learning algorithm that would start to detect crystals in stones. And we kind of came into that environment and said, hey, but we have the technology and the means to do this very quickly outside of your bureaucratical scientific institutional steps. We worked with an amazing computer scientist called Aaron Leon, who basically took the foundations of that algorithm and sped it up into a way that also had anomalies in it. So you see an algorithm that is basically controlling a DOP, a virtual DOP, a director of photography, and directing this camera to search for rare earth minerals inside this stone. So it's a kind of camera that moves around, it dances around, it goes through the space in search of something rare. And the algorithm is also coded in a way that while it's learning about these minerals and searching for them, it also gets distracted by other things that are rare, so by anomalies. It might see some weird kind of hole, it might see a weird shape. There are different parameters in which rare is being manifested. And it's also learning from the archive itself. And when the algorithm finds something of interest, the camera itself actually drills into that point of interest. So again, we're using the kind of language of extraction within the cinematic approach of filming. And this is very important because it's about like always putting these two worlds in dialogue, the world of cinema and the world of extractionism, as a way of kind of showing them as a kind of also form of protest, I guess.
Es ist eine Ansammlung von Mikroskopbildern. Und zwar sind das Mikroskopbilder aus alten Bergbauarchiven, soweit ich weiß, auch aus holländischen Kolonialgebieten, als da in Minen abgebaut wurde, also sowohl aus solchen Archiven bis hin zur Neuzeit. Und normalerweise gibt es Algorithmen, also kein Mensch sitzt mehr und sortiert solche Bilder aus, sondern es gibt Algorithmen. Da wir aber oder der Künstler ja nichts aus dem Boden wegnehmen will, ist diese Art des Algorithmus ja nicht zielführend.
Ja.
Und er hat sich überlegt, wir suchen nach Formen, die schön sind und Farben, die besonders ins Auge fallen.
Also a training for the human eye to adjust or to tune to those things that we used to use and see, but in a different way. Like, for example, normally we see these stones exactly on fancy kitchens or in bathrooms, etc. And we don't really pay attention to them anymore. But I think, like, the strong point about this, of the beauty, is really that, like, through the eyes of the scientist / artist, it gets turned into something else that suddenly makes you remarkably close to those kind of cold materials that normally you just perceive from far away and you don't think there's any connection between your body as a resonance body and the stone or the screen in that sense. So I think that's also something what happens there. Talking to the, hopefully you will see when you come there and you can agree to it. But it's something that I realized also on the afterwards.
And also what I was thinking now, that like within each face, there are so many other faces to see. The minerals, like you are looking through to look on what happens with the minerals. So I think in every like work, there are also different kind of faces or situations that are looking at each other. I like this like intertwinedness of different materials and context, yeah.
Yeah, for some reason, it just goes deeper and deeper. like extraction.
And then you realize, oh yeah, there's this other thing. Yeah.
Yeah, but this was also the feeling that this very distinctive feeling that Louis and I had, like at any step of the project, we discovered something new, or Louis discovered something new, and it distinctively made sense to add it or to make it bigger, because sometimes you also have these like projects where you're like, ah, yeah, but this is another research that actually should go somewhere else, or this should go somewhere else. Here it was really like, it just became more dense and dense and dense and more compressed into each other, which is then also a beautiful thing if you think about the petrified silence and how stones are made. If an idea becomes more dense and dense and dense over time, like becoming a stone.
Exactly. Yeah, and also the like different kinds of energies that creates. Coming to the soundtrack of the faces.
The film itself has a, how to say this? It has a score, a cinematic score, which is a waveform. Oh yeah, we're on a podcast, so I can't draw it, but the waveform is basically an upside, it's like a bell, it's a bell shape. And this is called a Rickett wave. And a Rickett wave is the waveform that is used by seismologists to search for minerals deep in the ground, for oil deep in the ground. And it's a waveform that is a kind of, it's either a sweep, like a ooh, or it's a pulse, like a ping. And so these waveforms are used for geologists to search when they don't want to dig. They send these sounds deep into the earth, and they listen to the echo of them as they reflect off a mineral. And then from that echo, they can decode how the sound wave distorted and changed its kind of characteristic. And from that, they can identify a type of mineral. So it's this kind of remote sensing for mineralogies. It's like the pre-extraction phase. And it's very interesting because there is a lot of intimacy that is also lost in this act because it's done at a distance, you know. There's this kind of speculation, there's a whole market with the stock and the metal exchange that starts to speculate on all these things that we don't see. So there's a whole economy also around this one sound wave going deep into the earth. And so the whole film is actually, the pace or the rhythm of the film is based on this sound wave. So it starts off slow, it goes very fast in the middle, and then comes back down. So the whole film is actually just one sound reflection that we see. And this is composed with the face one, which is the stonework. And for the last few years, I've been working with the Royal Meteorological Institute in the Netherlands. And they have a specialist there called Laszlo Evers, who is basically looking at low-frequency sounds and particularly looking at this form of infrasound, which is a sound wave between 0 and 20 hertz. So it's just outside our tuned ear frequency range, but it's one that is of that we can tune into with our bodies. So if you go to a techno club and they have a really good subwoofer system, this is the, you're getting down to those 20 hertz where you start to feel those vibrations through your body. Or like before an earthquake happens, if you start to feel that tremor also, that's a very similar low frequency range. And so the piece is composed of recordings that have been made over the last 3-4 years. With microphones that can listen to these low frequency sounds that were developed with scientists in Utrecht, and we developed this microphone that can record all these sounds. And the recordings, you know, we're not talking about like a 20 minute recording, we're talking about a recording that lasts 1 year, a recording that can last 30 days, and so the recording is also changing the idea of listening, because listening is being something very long. You know, what happens when you hear a recording that is 6 months long and you hear it in 60 seconds? How does that change our concept of listening outside the immediate, you know? And so they were playing with this a lot. We're playing with compressed sounds, compressed ecology. Everything is kind of at different resolutions. And I love this word resolutions because it's also about how we see things, but also how we see things under different compressions. And so this is also what the sound piece is it's kind of its own atmosphere, which entangles the two works together. And we play with these sweeps, so we play with the sounds of extraction itself, the scientists' sonic algorithms that are the sweeps up, the pings, the kind of sounds that search for the minerals. But at the same time, we allow the minerals to speak back, and we allow them to talk through their own bodies, which is simulated, where we play with, we analyze the minerals, we look at their densities, we look at their types of characteristics, and then we see how would this sound exist through this body. And so the sound piece is going through all these different rumbles and revelations and reverbs, and it's not really composed, actually. The minerals themselves decide how everything sounds. We just send the simulation, and we say how many sweeps, how many pings, and then let the stone talk back, and that's what you hear in the piece.
it's 12 channels. And then there are three subwoofer channels, so three really big subs in the space, two high tones, normal speakers, and then the other six that we have, but now we're at 11, not at 12. I think we have 11 channels at the moment, but I may be also mistaken. The other ones are transducers attached to the stone itself, that are directly attached to the stone and put the stone and also the glass discs and parts into vibration. And then the soundscape is pushed through this. So some things we really feel very bodily in the space while we stand in front of it. Some frequencies, like there are sounds that we can't hear because they're infrasonic, but by being coming through the stone, they actually become audible because the stone resonates in its own frequency or the glass. So this is things where it's really like something that we can't actually otherwise wouldn't hear. So the stone is really an instrument. And then there's this other layer of if you touch the stone, you feel the vibration that is even deeper.
Und wenn man noch ein bisschen länger hier steht, dann merkt man, dass wir das nicht nur über die Hände wahrnehmen, sondern auch in uns drin, im Rumpf.
Vibriert es dann auch.
Vibriert es auch. Wir spüren die Schwingung. Und das ist sicherlich etwas, was der Künstler für uns versucht hat. Der Lewis Braddock Clark beschäftigt sich mit Infraschall. Und Infraschall ist ja ein Frequenzbereich, den wir nicht hören können. Unser Ohr kann Frequenzen unter 20 Hertz nicht hören. Und wir sind im Prinzip taub gegenüber dieser Frequenzwelt. Und sein Versuch ist das letztendlich, uns diese Frequenzen oder diesen Frequenzbereich doch erlebbar oder wahrnehmbar zu machen. Weil wir hören ihn zwar nicht mit den Ohren, aber wir können ihn irgendwie mit unserem Körper hören oder wahrnehmen.
And then also what's, I think, really interesting if we move this also one step further was the realization that the Lichthaus in itself is a subwoofer. And it's in an architecture of a cloister that is from the 1600s, I believe. So when we realize the Lichthaus is a subwoofer, so it also amplifies the sound into the space in a very interesting way and becomes a very strong resonant chamber that adds another layer to how you perceive the work. And I'm very curious if the work ever will be perceived again like this, because there's this distinct sound that it makes. And then even more crazy is if you stand on this cloister square, there are some places in which you stand on this on the space, and Louis was running around sometimes and just standing and like feeling all of a sudden you are in a bubble in which the resonance becomes so big that you really... It shakes through all of you, which gives a very beautiful, beautiful notion of site specificity that we could have never imagined actually beforehand.
The nice thing is also is that the film work runs continuously day and night, and so you can also just like happen to arrive there late at night and just be in front of also of this this film and encounter these things and come back also at another point. But I think like it's more something to discover. I think the work allows for a certain intimacy and makes you vibrating that we hope that the audience also loosen up themselves and allow for these kind of explorations or findings.
How long do you spend time with it? There's people that come in that have a look around, they touch it and they leave, and then there's people that stay. And I think this like feeling part is something that shouldn't be explained, but this is the hidden gem that only comes out if you actually give it the time, if you meditate. And we had people that one of the founders of the Kunstverein actually, Andrea, she was really like standing in the build-up, both hands on the stone, and was standing there for 20 minutes just meditating on the stone. And you're like, wow, how can this happen?
Es geht natürlich auch darum, Infraschallbereich gibt es im Natürlichen, Sinne, also in der Natur. Wir haben eben über Wale und Elefanten schon kurz geredet. Es ist auch etwas, das in der Natur vorkommt, was aber für uns keine gute Bedeutung hat. Es ist ein Geräusch bei Vulkanen, also Vulkanausbrüchen. Es ist bei Erdbeben, bei Plattenverschiebungen, Bewegungen, Tsunamiwellen. Da ist es von Natur aus da. Und wir Menschen fügen dem Ganzen noch unseren eigenen produzierten Infraschall hinzu. Bergbau, haben wir schon drüber geredet, ist wirklich ein ganz wesentliches Thema, auch wenn jetzt hier in Europa Bergbau nicht mehr so groß geschrieben ist. Deswegen ist auch die Arnsberg hier als Stadt ausgesucht worden für die Ausstellung. Auch wir haben hier in der Region Bergbau gehabt, na, bis ins letzte Jahrhundert noch Schiefer. Aber ansonsten ist Bergbau natürlich hier jetzt in Europa ja nicht mehr das große Thema. Aber es gibt noch genug Länder, ne, wo Bergbau eben in großem Stil betrieben wird. Und das ist halt auch die Erinnerung daran, was machen wir eigentlich? Was machen wir mit den Tieren? Wir hören, dass Wale stranden, dass Zugvögel ihre Routen nicht mehr finden, ja, vom Weg abkommen, Wale stranden. Das ist sicherlich auch Folge des Infraschalls, den wir so sorglos in die Natur schicken, ohne dass wir uns Gedanken drüber machen. Gut, wir hören es nicht, wird auch vom militärischen Bereich genutzt. Waffentests, Atomtests sind alle im Infraschallbereich, also sehr unauffällig. Ja.
Ja.
Und das ist sicherlich kein Zufall, dass man sich diesen Frequenzbereich auch überlegt hat, wenn man Waffen konzipiert und testet. Hm. Genau. Ja, also das ist auch sicherlich nochmal eine Motivation des Künstlers, dass wir da wirklich doch auch ein Augenmerk drauf haben sollten.
Since I think we have to come to an end now, I wanted to ask you in this very long and also short, as we mentioned, process, both I think, first, I wanted to ask you about the collaboration aspect, because I think it also came through in this talk now that you worked very collaboratively together, and there were like very different disciplines and perspectives that you were also combining in this project. And what have you found within these very collaborative work and this togetherness you created?
Yeah, I think what is really important is that when you're also tackling very complex topics, you have to immediately remove egos, you know? You have to remove these ideas of egos and artistic egos and this idea of singularity and move into spaces of producing works that do deal with knowledge and complexities of knowledge, but also find ways of sharing and carrying that load, you know? It's also a very much a shared responsibility to go through these things together and find collective ways of protesting against extractionism, colonialism, all these forms of oppression we have to do together. This is the only way, I think. And this is very what we see now in the cultural scene, is that doing these things together can change things. And this is why I think we have to also work with the scientists, we have to work with old alchemists that are no longer with us, we have to work with the future, we have to work with the whales, we have to work with atmospheres, gases, and people, and all these teams and these amazing people together. And I think it becomes a family between the humans, the non-humans, and the more than humans, and all different types of chemistries. They all exist together. And I think this is the only way in which we can tackle these really hard times that we are living in also.
What have you learned in this process for yourself, or maybe about listening, about working with the earth and geology?
Stones are heavy.
The most interesting thing that came out of it was also like this topic of attunement. I mean, I work also on this topic, but like, and I have worked also with my students, like in seminars about like, how can we actually listen to the non-human actors around us? And I think like Louis really showed it, how it's possible to not listen with our ears, but listen through deep time whalebone ears, through layers of silence that become sound in human bodies. And I think like this translation and this transformation of hearing, I think like I really saw it materializing there, and I think that was for me something, I don't know what I learned about it, but what I saw into practice, that I can say like it was this really worked out
for me on a work level. It was also interesting. Normally I'm quite distant in the process with artists in creating their work, so normally I follow a philosophy in which I don't want to interfere too much with the artistic process, because otherwise I would overstretch my role as a curator. Through the intimate collaboration that I had with Louis before, there was a lot of trust. So I was way deeper involved in feedbacking and talking. So this role of between artist and curator blurred a lot. And I think it blurred on every element, not only with me. It never felt that we had all fixed positions. It was always we collaborators. So, and stronger maybe than in most other projects, it felt every person that was part of the journey was a collaborator rather than having a certain role assigned to them. Even the transport people, everybody was thinking along, because you're like, but how to do this and how can we do this? And then like, because it is such a weird thing to do to a certain extent. And the stonemasons were also like, we normally do gravestones and we cut Fensterbänke, and that's it. So to then, they were like, but why do you want holes in a 3 meter by 1 meter 70 stone plate? This doesn't make any sense for us. Why should we think about this? And it was very fun to stretch these boundaries across understandings and disciplines.
I mean, I think for me it's very much about talking also along the lines of entombment, from what Pauline mentions, is to find this intimacy. You know, the fact that when we talk about ecological crisis, or we talk about crisis in general, is that there is this great distance between being in proximity or intimacy with it. Like when we talk about, I don't know, the percentages and the data and the numerics of everything, it's cold, right? And for me, it's very important that there is this intimacy that is created within the artworks, that one is drawn into the research and drawn closer in. And I think that's something that I didn't expect to happen here, and it was very emotional for me on the first day of the opening to see these crowds of people like literally like up close and touching. And I think for me that's a very beautiful thing to learn, is that you can really create these moments of intimacy with other species, and they do exist. We just have to find these forms of slowing down and changing our magnitudes and changing our complete understanding of what it means to sense. And I think this is, for me, like really going to be what comes next, is to really further dismantle our own self to understand how we can amplify and voice these more than others.